extraordinary leaders can transcend their circumstances. And when they do so, they not only have the possibility to inspire dreams of a better world, but they also have the opportunity to liberate humankind from the bonds of memory and ideology.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Melvin P. Loeffler, the author of For the Soul of Mankind, The United States, the Soviet Union, and the Cold War, is, as we like to say, a homeboy. He is not only a prominent member of the Miller Center faculty, he's been a professor at the University of Virginia since 1986. He did his undergraduate work at Cornell and his PhD at Ohio State. After arriving at the University of Virginia, he served as dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. He then took a leave and went to Oxford, where he was the Harmsworth Professor in the 2002-2003 academic year. And the year following, he was the Henry Kissinger Fellow at the Library of Congress. He is currently researching a new book, which will be out next summer, on After the Bush Policy. His previous books have received the highest critical acclaim. His book, A Preponderance of Power, National Security, the Truman Administration, and the Cold War, won the Big Three, the Bancroft, Farrell, and Hoover Prizes in 1993. The Specter of Communism, the United States, and the Origins of the Cold War appeared in 1994. Please welcome Mel Loeffler.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to thank George for that very nice introduction. I do want to correct one thing that he said. The new book that literally went to the press yesterday is a co-edited volume with my colleague here at the Miller Center, Jeff LeGros, and it's called To Lead the World, National Security After the Bush Doctrine, and hopefully that book will be out this summer. But it's not a book that I myself have written. It's a book that Jeff LeGros and I have co-edited after a terrifically good conference last June here at the Miller Center with some of the most eminent spokespersons and experts on national security policy. Yesterday, I had the chance to be on a little radio show, and I was interviewed here in Charlottesville, and the person interviewing me started off the program by saying to this listening audience out there, he said something like, well, this is a really exciting weekend coming up in Charlottesville. Tonight we have the Bob Dylan concert, and on Saturday we have the UVA-Pittsburgh game, and we have the races at Foxfield. And then he went on, and don't forget the most important thing is Mel Loeffler's 11 o'clock talk tomorrow at the Miller Center. So I want to thank all of you for coming out for this high visibility event here in Charlottesville. So I've written a lot about the origins of the Cold War, and I'm often asked, you know, why did I undertake to write yet another book about the whole Cold War? And the answer is complex, but there are two overriding reasons why I wanted to write a book about the entire Cold War. First of all, I was genuinely surprised at the end of the Cold War. I never anticipated the Cold War to end when it did. I was intellectually challenged. I mean, just think about it. For 40 years, the Cold War engulfed our lives. For 40 years, we thought we were living on the threshold of a nuclear catastrophe. We thought that there could literally be a nuclear war. These apprehensions were real. Nowadays, we look back and we reflect, and we look upon the Cold War as a nostalgic era where the threat was simple and the world was easy to understand. But the Cold War for 40 years was a terribly scary international environment. And then suddenly, the Cold War was over. Hardly anyone anticipated the Cold War to end, and it ended peacefully. And it's really a challenge to try to understand why it ended, when it ended, and if it did end so swiftly in the mid and late 1980s, why in the world did it not end earlier? Why could leaders in the United States and the Soviet Union not put an end to the Cold War in the late 40s, or the 50s, or the 60s, or whenever? And so, in part, I was challenged to try to explain the underlying dynamics of the Cold War, why it continued for so long, and why it ended when it did. Then I was also felt that I wanted to write about a history of the whole Cold War, because in the 1990s, these documents began to appear from the Soviet Union, from Moscow, from Eastern Europe, from China. Documents that Western historians never imagined they would have a chance to look at. And these documents were unbelievably interesting, unbelievably interesting. We have memoranda, for example, now of Stalin's talks with Eastern European communist leaders in 1944, 1945, 1946. We have notes of the Politburo meetings under Khrushchev in the late 1950s and early 1960s. We have many memoranda from meetings of the Warsaw Pact, where Brezhnev talked to the leaders of Poland and Eastern Germany. We have these fascinating minutes of discussions among Soviet leaders in 1979, when in the spring of 1979, they thought about intervening in Afghanistan directly and decided not to. 6 months later, in late November, December 1979, top Soviet leaders met again to talk about whether or not to intervene in Afghanistan, and they decided that they needed to do so. We have those minutes now. We can see what was on the minds of top Soviet officials. We have the transcripts of all the meetings between Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev. All these documents provide insights that we never thought we would have, and that really has intrigued me tremendously and prompted me to write an overall history of the Cold War. Now, two aspects of the new documents really have impressed me. First, Soviet leaders really believed they were creating a superior civilization. They truly believed they represented an alternative and better way of organizing human existence. This was not just rhetoric that they used in their public speeches. We can now see in their deliberations that they really cared about their system, and they thought their system would be more responsive to the needs and sensibilities of their own people as well as to other people's. In essence, they were, in their own minds, waging a struggle for the soul of mankind. And so did American officials. Where did this expression, for the soul of mankind, come from? It came from a statement by George Herbert Walker Bush, who wrote, "The Cold War was a struggle for the very soul of mankind." That's the way he perceived it. When I first read that about 6 years ago, I didn't necessarily agree with that, but as I did more and more research on the Cold War, the insight provided by that little phrase, "the Cold War was a struggle for the soul of mankind," actually represented a lot about what was going on in Washington as well as in Moscow. So that was one big generalization that emerged from the new documents. But a second big generalization that has emerged from the new documents, and that truly surprised me, was that leaders in Moscow as well as in Washington, often grasped that the Cold War dynamic was counter-effective, that the Cold War dynamic undermined their own national interests. Yes, leaders in Moscow, as well as those in Washington, believed that Cold War rivalry diverted resources and attention from domestic priorities. They believed that the Cold War embroiled them in wars on the periphery that had no real bearing on vital interests. And leaders in Moscow, as well as in Washington, grasped almost throughout the Cold War that a scenario could develop that would culminate in catastrophe. Hence, what was so striking about the documents that one can see from the archives in Moscow, as well as from those in Washington, is that cooperation often seemed better than Cold War. Cooperation often seemed better than Cold War. Now, in my book, I take five moments, short historical periods during the Cold War, when I show that leaders in Moscow, as well as in Washington, wanted to either avoid the Cold War, modulate the Cold War, or disengage from the Cold War. So my first chapter is about Stalin and Truman and the origins of the Cold War. Both leaders, I argue, said they wanted to avoid a rupture of the great wartime coalition. They wanted to avoid a rupture of the great wartime coalition. They wanted to sustain collaboration into the post-war period. They not only said this to one another, what's so fascinating in the documents that we now have from Moscow is that we can see Stalin saying this to his communist comrades. We need to try to sustain collaboration. It's in our interest to do so. That's my quote, Bolshevik view of the issue. My second chapter is about the period 1953 and 1954, right after Stalin's death, when the new Soviet leaders were very insecure. Malenkov, Khrushchev, Molotov, Beria, they felt very insecure. They wanted to tamp down and diffuse the Cold War. And President Eisenhower gave a great public speech in April 1953, saying that we should give peace a chance. There's a new opportunity after Stalin's death. But yet, nothing came of this. And then my third chapter revolves around Khrushchev, Kennedy, and Johnson after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Khrushchev realized, we know from the meetings of the Presidium, Khrushchev realized that he had almost brought the world to a nuclear holocaust. He wanted to step back. And he writes a series of letters to John Kennedy saying, we need to re-explore our entire relationship and settle all problems. Kennedy initially is very ambivalent about this. But then in June of 1963, he gives this major speech at American University in which he says, we really need to think about an entirely new relationship with the Soviet Union. We really need to give peace a chance. Maybe we can make it a reality. But then, by the spring of 1965, those efforts that go on under Kennedy, under Khrushchev, and then under Johnson actually peter out. Then in the mid-1970s, Brezhnev and Carter work hard, very hard, to sustain détente after the signing of the Helsinki Agreements of 1975. But they fail to do so. Then in my last chapter, I look at Reagan and Gorbachev. Both leaders said many times, publicly and privately, that nuclear weapons made no sense, and governments should do everything possible to end this irrational nuclear arms race. They said that. Now, my book is about why in each of the first four cases, when policymakers said they wanted to avoid a Cold War or modulate it or disengage from it, why they failed to do so. And then I try to explain why in the mid and late 1980s, Reagan and Gorbachev were able to disengage from the Cold War, sustain detente, and then ultimately end the Cold War. Now, it's by no means clear in the literature, and certainly probably many of you are thinking, is this really true that leaders wanted to cooperate? Is it really true that the brutal Stalin wanted to cooperate with the West? And the answer to that is yes. Of course he wanted to cooperate on his own terms, just like Truman wanted cooperation on his own terms. We know from the records why Stalin wanted to cooperate with the West at the end of the war, and particularly with the United States. The overwhelming reason why he wanted to was his fear about the future evolution of German power. The specter of Germany and of a revived German power hovered over the entire Cold War. And it's in initial phases, one of the compelling reasons to try to sustain cooperation was the notion that with the West, together, the future power of Germany could be controlled. Everyone understood, and Stalin says this time and time again in his deliberations with Eastern European leaders, Western European leaders, with Roosevelt, with Churchill, with de Gaulle, with the leaders from Eastern Europe. Germany will revive. Germany will revive, and we need to take cognizance of this. And that's a good reason for sustaining collaboration, to control the revival of German power. But Stalin also had other reasons to try to sustain collaboration. He was eager for a loan from the United States in order to help reconstruct the Soviet Union. He was eager to gather as much reparations as he possibly could from the Western zones in Germany, from the zones occupied by France, Britain, and the United States. His ability to secure reparations from these zones depended on sustaining collaboration and cooperation with the West. So yes, he wanted cooperation, not because he was a good guy. I show in tremendous detail just how brutal and repressive he was. But nonetheless, it would serve his national interest to cooperate. Yet cooperation ultimately proved impossible. And what's so interesting about Truman, his counterpart on the American side, was Truman was wary of the growth of Soviet power from the moment he became president. He was wary of the growth of Soviet power, and many historians claim that he was uninterested in sustaining the great wartime coalition that Roosevelt had helped to put together. But I argue differently. I argue that Truman, like Roosevelt, wanted to continue wartime cooperation. Yes, he feared the potential growth of Soviet power, but at the same time, he was not affronted by Stalin's brutality. He wrote his wife after meeting Stalin at Potsdam for the first time, "I like Stalin. I can deal with him. He's smart as hell, but he's willing to compromise." And indeed, a decade later, long after his presidency, Truman gave a public speech in which he said, "Yes, when I reflect on it, it's true. I really liked Stalin when we first met. I thought he was a person I could deal with." So Stalin's record of brutality is not a key to understanding the Cold War. The key to understanding the Cold War, the origins of the Cold War, and its continuation for four decades, I show in my book, relates to a number of critical variables. And this is what I explore in each of these chapters. First, I show that in a counterintuitive sense, policymakers saw reasons to collaborate and cooperate, but they were unable to sustain that cooperation. And why was that? And to illuminate the reasons, I look at five different variables. First, in each situation, I look at conditions in the international environment. Neither Stalin nor Truman nor Eisenhower, nor Malenkov, nor Khrushchev or Kennedy created these basic conditions in the international system. But those conditions dictated so much that went on. What were the critical conditions? First of all, the political ferment at the end of the war in Europe, the social chaos, the economic paralysis. This created perceptions of danger and perceptions of opportunity. The vacuums of power in Germany and Japan created enormous apprehensions about the future. What would happen to Germany over the long run? What would happen to Japan? Policymakers in every capital knew that the occupation would eventually end and German power would revive. How do you deal with the future of Germany? How do you control its future trajectory? This was on everybody's mind, and it conjured up perceptions of fear and perceptions of opportunity. And the third variable in the international system that actually grew more and more important in the 1950s and 60s and culminated in the middle 1970s was the process of decolonization in Asia and Africa. Revolutionary nationalism that went on for three decades created perceptions of great opportunity in Moscow, that they could capitalize on this distress in the Third World. And that very process of decolonization conjured up great fears in Washington that the adversary would, in fact, be able to capitalize. So for policymakers on both sides, in Moscow and in Washington, international circumstances conjured up danger, but international circumstances also conjured up opportunity that policymakers often found hard to resist. Now, what I show in my book is that the fears and hopes of leading officials in Moscow and Washington were shaped by ideology and by historical memory. Ideology suggested to Stalin that capitalism would founder and that he could exploit divisions among his capitalist adversaries. Ideology suggested to Stalin that peoples in the Third World, in Asia and Africa, would liberate themselves from colonial exploitation and choose the route of Marxism-Leninism to rapid modernization. Ideology suggested to Stalin that he would be encircled and he would be squeezed if he demonstrated any weakness whatsoever. Ideology suggested to Truman that peoples would choose individual rights and free markets. Ideology suggested to Truman and his successors that a free political economy at home required an open marketplace abroad. In addition to ideology, historical memory was critical. For the Soviet Union, the overriding memory was that of war. The overriding memory was that of German aggressiveness. The overriding memory was that the Nazis killed 8 to 9 million Soviet soldiers during World War II. The overriding memory was that the Nazis murdered 7 million Russian civilians during World War II. The overriding memory was that 26 to 27 million Soviet citizens died during the war. This memory resonates throughout the Cold War and shapes a lot of what happens. But for Americans, there was also historical memory. The historical memory for Truman and for his successors was that when totalitarian powers gain control of the resources and manpower of Europe and Asia, they used those resources to wage a protracted war against the United States. That was the great lesson of the 1930s. The great lesson for American policymakers was that they could not allow the Soviet Union directly or indirectly to gain control of the resources and manpower of Europe and Asia. So this historical memory, combined with ideology, made it very difficult to sustain the very cooperation that policymakers often articulated was in their nation's interests. But in addition to looking at the international environment and at ideology and memory, in each of my chapters, I also look at domestic politics and domestic institutions and show how those factors constrained policymakers. Yes, policymakers articulated a desire to tamp down the competition. Johnson, when he became president after Kennedy's death, wanted to sustain the emerging détente, but he failed to do so. In February of 1965, Johnson begins bombing North Vietnam. Not only does he begin bombing North Vietnam, most significantly, he begins bombing North Vietnam when the Soviet premier, Alexei Kosygin, is actually in Hanoi. Now, Johnson had been told the Soviet premier is there. This is the worst possible time to begin bombing. The Soviets are going to see this as an insult. It's going to set back the very détente you're trying to nurture. And yet, Johnson could not resist bombing. He could not resist it because he was haunted by fears that his domestic foes, his domestic political foes, would take advantage of a situation in which his policies failed in Indochina. And so he decided he had to demonstrate strength, even though it ruptured the emerging détente. And likewise, I look at the Soviet Union and domestic politics and bureaucratic and organizational imperatives inside the Kremlin. And what's so interesting, for example, is that in the middle 1970s, Brezhnev earnestly wanted to sustain détente. That's what he cared about more than anything else. Signing a SALT II agreement with Carter, continuing the policies that he and Nixon had inaugurated in the very late 60s and the early 70s. Brezhnev wanted détente. There's no question about it in the historical record that we now have. But at the same time, he could not control party ideologues and his own military leaders who were lured into adventures in the Third World, especially in Angola and in the Horn of Africa. And the key to understanding this is the wave of decolonization that culminates in the mid-1970s, for example, the end of the Portuguese Empire and the civil war and civil turmoil that goes on in Angola, and the dynamics that this creates for Soviet leaders who want to take advantage of these situations, to do so, even though Brezhnev himself showed hardly any interest in these sorts of things, but he could not control his own bureaucracy, his own military leadership. I also look at the pressures generated by allies and clients. Yes, the allies and clients of the Soviet Union and the United States often exerted significant pressure upon them and often constrained them when they wanted to relax tensions. America's allies and the allies and clients of the Soviet Union often had a vested interest in sustaining the Cold War and didn't want their patrons in Moscow and Washington necessarily to relax tensions. and I tried to show how these dynamics play themselves out. But most importantly, my book focuses on the leaders themselves, on Stalin and Truman, Eisenhower and Malenkov, etc. And I try to, in my book, to capture their essential character traits. I try to illuminate their beliefs, their hopes, their fears, their dreams. I try to analyze the competing impulses that they felt. On the one hand, a desire to cooperate. On the other hand, a strong desire to compete. These were conflicting impulses that existed within the same individuals. And I show how until the mid-1980s, the leaders, for the most part, could not transcend their circumstances. They could not overcome their ideological predilections. They often could not control their allies and clients. And they could not liberate themselves from fears of domestic humiliation. But in the last chapter of the book, I show how Reagan and Gorbachev overcame the constraints of the past. First, I show that the international environment was actually much more permissive. After the early 1970s, until at least 1989 or 90, the German problem finally had seemed to be solved in the early 1970s. Secondly, in terms of the international environment, the era of decolonization seemed to have ended after the breakup of the Portuguese Empire in the mid-1970s. The end of the decolonization process, the end of the repeated cycle of revolutionary nationalism that had lasted for three decades, transformed the calculus of threat and opportunity in the Third World. I also show why in the middle 1980s, domestic political circumstances in Moscow and in Washington made a relaxation of tensions more feasible. But most of all, in this last chapter of the book, a very long chapter, I examine the unique qualities of Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev, and I try to illuminate how their leadership made a huge difference. And what I say about Reagan will surprise you, because the emphasis in my chapter is not on Reagan's buildup of military strength, which we all know about and which is important. But what I focus on is Reagan's desire to negotiate with the adversary. We all know from Reagan's public rhetoric and from the writing of his hagiographers and from the very ample writings of neoconservatives that Reagan not only built military strength, but excoriated the evil empire. And that is true. That's part of the public record. But what has not been known and what is amply documented now in the Reagan Presidential Library is that at the same time that Ronald Reagan was calling the Soviet Union an evil empire publicly, he was writing a series of private letters to Soviet leaders, first Brezhnev, then Andropov, then Chernenko, even before Gorbachev, a series of private letters in which he said things like the following. Within days after he would make an evil empire speech, for example, he would write to a Soviet leader, and I'm quoting, "I have no greater goal than the establishment of a relationship between our two countries characterized by constructive cooperation. We seek to defend our interests, but not to challenge your security. I have reflected on Soviet losses through the ages. Surely those losses are beyond description and must affect your thinking today. I want you to know that neither I nor the American people hold any offensive or intentions toward you or the Soviet people. Our constant and urgent purpose must be a lasting reduction of tensions between us. I pledge to you my profound commitment to that end. And some of these letters he wrote in his personal hand in order to underscore their authenticity to the Soviet leadership, that this is what he wanted. And Reagan, now that we have his diaries, wrote the following one day in his diary. I think it was 1984. He wrote, 3 years had taught me something surprising about the Russians. Many people at the top of the Soviet hierarchy were genuinely afraid of America. Perhaps that shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. So what's so interesting about Reagan and why he's so important in terms of understanding the end of the Cold War is that, one, he wanted to negotiate with the adversary while he built up strength. Strength was a key to negotiation. But two, in planning to negotiate with the adversary, he actually got to understand the sensibilities and fears of the enemy in ways that he had never entertained before. So Reagan, I argue, was critical to the end of the Cold War. But so was Gorbachev. And in my book, Gorbachev is the indispensable agent for bringing about the end of the Cold War. Ideology, I show, remained of extreme importance to Gorbachev. To the very end of the Soviet Union, he did believe that he represented a superior system. But he wanted to make that system work better. He wanted to make the system to work better. Therefore, he had to focus on what he called perestroika, restructuring of the economy, and glasnost, openings. And to do that, to make his domestic reforms work, he needed to relax, in his view, international tensions. He needed to relax international tensions, and he thereby shift resources from the military economy to domestic priorities. And what's so fascinating about Gorbachev is that while he remained a committed communist throughout these years, he nonetheless readjusted some of the most basic Marxist-Leninist axioms. He came to believe, most importantly, that capitalist powers were not inveterately hostile. He came to believe that the West genuinely feared the Soviet Union, and that he had to allay the apprehensions in the West, and that he had to take extraordinary risks to do this, to break through what political scientists would call the security dilemma. And he was convinced that given Soviet nuclear capabilities, nobody would attack the Soviet Union. Nobody would attack the Soviet Union. And therefore, he could do things that seemed unprecedented. Now, other Soviet leaders had often said, no one's going to attack us. We have a tremendous number of nuclear weapons. But nobody before Gorbachev was willing to act upon it and make the types of concessions that he made. And he does this because he believes the external threats to the Soviet Union are small. He once said, we are surrounded, not by invincible armies, but by superior economies. And also, Gorbachev realized that external opportunities were small. He was no longer tempted to intervene in the Third World because he grasped that the model of the Soviet Union was no longer appealing to Third World nations because the Soviet economy was faltering. To make the Soviet economy an attractive model, He had to refashion it at home. He had to make the system work better at home in order for it to be appealing abroad. Now, Gorbachev failed miserably in his efforts to reform that domestic economy. But in the process of doing so, and in the process of trying to allay the fears in the West, he played an indispensable role in bringing about the end of the Cold War. And I like to think there are three big, broad generalizations that are worth thinking about in conclusion. First, military power did not win the Cold War. In fact, I would say that foreign policy did not win the Cold War. Those of us who write about the Cold War write about foreign policy. We write about power projection. We write about the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, Point 4, the Alliance for Progress. But these things were not ultimately critical. What was critical was that the West won the Cold War because democratic capitalism in the United States and social democracy in Western Europe proved their superiority over a command economy. Our way of life, the way of life in Western Europe, proved that it was capable of meeting the needs of people far better than a command economy. That is a great lesson to take away from the Cold War. Making your domestic way of life successful and appealing is probably more critical than anything else. Second, big generalization. Negotiation was a key to the end of the Cold War. Ronald Reagan always said you needed to negotiate from strength. But unlike many of his predecessors in Washington, Reagan really believed that once you built strength, you needed to negotiate, and he was willing to negotiate. And he understood that negotiation did not necessarily mean that you would make unwarranted compromises, but negotiation was instrumental for bringing about the end of the Cold War. And a third big generalization, for those of us who study international relations and write diplomatic history, is a reminder that when we do so, when we write the history of international relations, we need to integrate the structure of the international system with an analysis of ideology and historical memory, with a focus on domestic politics, and with a grasp of human agency. In other words, into the history of international relations is a complex woven tapestry, not individual pieces of cloth. Now, many people say that my book is about lost opportunities. And my book does show that opportunities are lost when powerful leaders are engulfed by circumstance, entrapped by ideology, and haunted by fears of domestic political foes. But my book, I like to think, is even more about hope than about lost opportunities. And that's because my book shows that extraordinary leaders can transcend their circumstances. Extraordinary leaders can grow, and they can learn to appreciate the fears and the aspirations of their adversaries. And when they do so, they not only have the possibility to inspire dreams of a better world, but they also have the opportunity to liberate humankind from the bonds of memory and ideology. Thank you.
your book, of course, focuses on the two superpowers, but clearly they did not exist in a vacuum. What interactions with third-party nations did you find were the most important in either reinforcing or undermining the fear-driven ideology that you say accounts for the prolongation of the war?
Well, that's a great question, and looking at actors other than those in Washington and in Moscow is important for understanding the dynamics of the Cold War. One of the most interesting episodes in the Cold War is actually during the period of the 1970s, when Brezhnev, as I was saying earlier, and Carter, first Ford and then Carter, really wanted to keep SALT II negotiations on track. But you had this civil war going on in Angola, and into that civil war stepped the Cubans, Castro. And Castro provided an enormous amount of critical assistance to one side in the civil war. The United States interpreted this, Henry Kissinger first, but then also Zbigniew Brzezinski interpreted this to mean that the Soviets were orchestrating the Cuban actions. And what we now know from an enormous amount of very detailed research is that Castro was acting on his own volition. Castro wanted to do this. He wanted to take advantage of the circumstances himself, in this situation. He himself thought he was part of this struggle for the soul of mankind and that the Cubans had something to offer to Africans and that the Cubans had been very active in Africa all through the 60s and 70s. Castro's actions made it incredibly difficult to tamp down the relationship. And that's a very good example of how a third world actor makes it so much more difficult for the policymakers to do what they say they wanted to do.
Mel, I look forward to reading this book, but there are two sort of factoids that I want you to comment on. In the deliberations between Truman and Stalin, what role did the bomb play? We had it. Stalin was trying to get it, but didn't have it at the time. That's one. And the second is, towards the end of your scenario, not up to Gorbachev, but the Andropov period, what about this incredible misunderstanding that the Soviets had that they called Project Ryan, where they thought the United States was actually building up to a first strike capability?
Those are great questions. And of course, there's a huge literature about the role of the atomic bomb and the origins of the Cold War. And there are a number of compelling books written by so-called revisionist scholars that essentially argue that possession of the atomic bomb infused Truman and his advisors with a great sense of American military strength, which they purposefully used in order to convey signals to the Soviet Union. And hence, these revisionist scholars argue that the dropping of the atomic bomb was related as much to a desire to intimidate the Soviets as to defeat the Japanese. Now, I do not embrace that interpretation in my book. But nonetheless, I do show in my book that Truman and his most influential advisors were in fact aware that if they used the bomb to defeat Japan, as they were determined to do, that it would have an extremely positive impact on their capacity to manage the Soviets. They did feel that if they used the bomb, it would make the Soviets more amenable to American aspirations. So my argument is that the bomb had a significant role in shaping the American-Soviet relationship. Americans were aware of the power of the bomb and its dramatic impact. And two, Stalin believed, and this is critical, Stalin believed, and we have a lot of information, that the Americans purposefully had used the bomb exactly for that reason, in order to have an impact on Soviet negotiating behavior. Stalin thought that the West believed that the Soviets would become more amenable to making concessions once the Soviets saw the power of the bomb. And what happens is that the exact opposite occurs. Stalin becomes actually more determined not to make concessions because he doesn't want the Americans to think that because they have the bomb, the Soviets are going to capitulate to American wishes. And so a very destructive dynamic begins to take place over the fact that the Americans do have the bomb and have used it. Now, the second most dramatic moment in the Cold War is actually in 1983, coupled with Project Ryan. And what this refers to is the fact that the United States was engaging in 1982 and 83 under Reagan in this tremendous military buildup. And the United States was undertaking military exercises. The military exercises were how the United States, you know, might act in terms of a real case war scenario. And the exercises were so dramatically realistic that the Kremlin actually believed that the Americans might be thinking of launching a surprise attack. And this is what is being alluded to here, that we know now from Soviet intelligence analyses that the Soviets actually believe the Americans might be thinking of launching a preemptive attack. And then our intelligence assessors understood or picked up information that this is what the Soviet intelligence community was thinking, that we might launch a premeditated, a preemptive attack. And our intelligence analysts actually went to Reagan and said, what's going on here is crazy, but it's true. We honestly have information that they think we're going to launch a preemptive attack. And that's what has a big impact on Reagan himself, that he is told convincingly that the Soviets think we really might launch such an attack. And we really, and Reagan's response to that is, well, we really need to modulate this situation. And he actually sends General Scowcroft, who is then a private citizen, sends him on a special mission to Moscow to have a quiet chat with the folks in the Kremlin and say, hey, your intelligence is not right. We're not thinking of doing this. We're just playing games.
Good morning. My name is Barın Kayoğlu. I'm a graduate student at the History Department here at UVA. I'm working with Mr. Leffler. Sir, my question is, at the end of your presentation, you said that that you would like to think of this book as one of telling a story of hope, not necessarily lost opportunities. But my question is actually about a lost opportunity and about the bomb. If that Reagan and Gorbachev walked a huge distance and ended the Cold War, why were they unable to do away with the bomb completely?
That's a very good question, and it's of course it's a totally counterfactual question because we don't really know what Reagan Gorbachev would have done over the long term if they both stayed in power. What we do know, and what really comes out in a remarkable way in their private discussions with one another, is that both men thought nuclear weapons were crazy. And they kept in their discussions with one another. What's interesting is that they say it. They both say, we want to get rid, you know, they both say to one another, we want to get rid of nuclear weapons. They make no sense. We're never going to be able to use them in wartime because they would be catastrophic. And we don't think they would really work in blackmailing the adversary, as was often feared, because they knew the adversary would really know they would never use them. And so why keep piling up all these nuclear weapons? And in fact, they make a real effort in their conversations with one another to sort of embark on a program. I don't want to get into the details. They're much too complicated to sort of really reduce nuclear weapons in a very significant way. Now, what's interesting, to answer your question, why they're not successful in getting rid of all nuclear weapons over the long run is, one, they're not in power, but two, hardly anybody in their administrations agreed with their views. What's interesting is that, you know, very few of Reagan's advisors really believed that his quest to abolish nuclear weapons was in American self-interest. In fact, when he started talking about this openly amongst his advisors in 1983 and 84, some of them were absolutely amazed. General Rowney, who was a key arms control negotiator, when he first heard Reagan in a meeting in the Oval Office say, you know, I'm really serious about moving ahead in this direction, we know from both that conversation and from diary entries afterwards that Rowney thought, this was my hero, Ronald Reagan, talking about abolishing nuclear weapons? And so there are a whole bunch of people, both in Washington and Moscow, who clearly did not want this to happen, and they constrain over a long period of time. And of course, you know, Reagan leaves office, Gorbachev is overthrown, and so, you know, if there were ever a chance to abolish nuclear weapons, and I don't really think there was, even though the policymakers like Reagan and Gorbachev talked that way, if there was ever a chance, with their departure from office, it became inconceivable, because George Herbert Walker Bush and General Scowcroft and James Baker and Robert Gates and Dick Cheney certainly didn't want to get rid of nuclear weapons, and nor did Gorbachev's successors. So that's, you know, in short, that's an answer to a very complicated question, a very good question.
Hi, I'm Laura Phillips. I'm in the History Department also. I had a question about your closing remarks. I thought it was really interesting that you said military power did not end the Cold War, and neither did foreign policy, but it was liberal capitalism in demonstrating that could better support a citizenry than the USSR's command economy. And I was just curious to what extent you think that the Cold War could have persisted with the crumbling of the Soviet state. Historians are asked to, you know, point out what are the proximate and the ultimate causes. And I would never, as an aspiring historian, make an argument for economic determinism, but I was just curious to what extent you think that necessarily precipitated the end of the Cold War and then when the policy players worked in.
Well, the end of the Cold War didn't come about because at any moment in time one policymaker or another said they wanted to end the Cold War. What Gorbachev said that he wanted to do, and what he not only said but did do, was to tamp down the arms race, to try to shift military expenditures to domestic priorities. And this was going to happen gradually. It wasn't something that would be dramatic. But he had to allay the tensions with the West. Why did he want to do this? Yes, it was because he realized that his economy was not doing what Soviet leaders had said for generations that it would do. And social democracy and democratic capitalism were proving that they could meet the needs of their peoples more effectively than could a command economy. What I show in my book, and what many will regard as controversial, is the fact that people like Malenkov, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, and Gorbachev took seriously the rhetoric that Soviet communism was obligated to produce a better life for their people. And what happened was that the Soviet system wasn't doing that. For a while, it looked like it might be doing that. And for a while, it looked like the Soviets were industrializing quickly and growing economically and providing more education and better health care for a while. But then that begins to stagnate in the 1950s, grows in the 1960s, grows worse in the 1970s, and really reaches a crisis in the middle 1980s. And that's what Gorbachev is trying to fix. And so I don't know if that's an economic interpretation. It's in part an economic interpretation, but it's also an ideological interpretation, because it really has a bearing on people's basic concepts about how they want to organize human existence and whether such a system is going to work or another system is going to work. And leaders in Washington and Moscow earnestly believed they were in a competition over how best to organize human existence. And the facts were demonstrating that social democracy, broadly defined in Western Europe, and democratic capitalism, broadly defined in the United States, were doing a better job of accomplishing the types of things that the Soviets said their system would do better.
Mel, that was a very challenging lecture, and I too look forward to reading the book. Very quick, simple question. Were the Soviet Union's national interests and America's national interests regarding Germany in the early post-war period irreconcilable, in your opinion?
I think they both had a shared interest that they were both very aware of in controlling the future of German power. So in that, they had a common denominator. But at the same time, each side feared that in terms of trying to control German power, the other side would co-opt German power for its own interests, or might actually create a system or a trajectory in which the Germans would gain control over their own power and once again become a threat. And so on one hand, yes, they had a shared interest, but they also had conflicting fears and ambitions that complicated the relationship. And one of the things I show throughout is that most of these issues, like the extraordinarily good one you raise here, Don, most of these issues are enveloped with competing impulses. Yes, we have a common interest in controlling German power, but oh gosh, what happens if the adversary doesn't want to share that control with us, but wants to harness German power for its own interests? How do we sort of make good on the prospect of joint control of German power without at the same time getting ensnared in a situation that's going to undermine our interests in the long run? And it's sort of trying to balance these things off that's so devilishly difficult.
Mel Leffler will sign copies.
Sell two.
that was correct. Mel Leffler will sign copies of For the Soul of Mankind out front after his talk, and I would ask everyone to stand their place and let Mel exit the room so he can get where he needs to be. The Economist, in its very positive review of this book, suggested that those who are running for the office of presidency should find this book must reading. As a University of Virginia person, I am a little bit fearful that if they read that, they'll pluck Mel and take him back into high government service. In any case, this is an important book, and we are very grateful for your being here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.